Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. President Donald Trump is set to move this week after suffering the worst defeat on his young presidency. With the words repeal and replace Obamacare still ringing in voters' ears, Mr. Trump's loudest campaign promise crashed when the Republican majority in Congress proved incapable of taking the first legislative step to put an alternative plan in place. By Sunday, Mr. Trump was venting his frustration on Twitter, blaming conservative Republican groups who had urged defeat of the bill. He tweeted, "Democrats are smiling in D.C. The Freedom Caucus, with the help of Club for Growth and Heritage, have saved Planned Parenthood and Ocare." White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus on Fox News Sunday attempted to quash the prominent news reports that Mr. Trump was blaming him and House Speaker Paul Ryan for the defeat. Officials from Cincinnati, which is in the U.S. Midwestern state of Ohio, say that a shooting inside a busy bar in which one person was killed and 15 others shot is not being considered an act of terrorism. It occurred early Sunday morning at the Cameo nightclub. Police Chief Elliot Isaac says it started after an altercation between several people within the bar.
This is a very large establishment. They do employ off-duty police officers to patrol the parking lot. They are required or responsible for the internal security themselves. It is my understanding that they do wand individuals and pat them down. However, what we know at this point, several firearms were able to be brought inside the bar.
Hundreds of people were in the club when the shooter opened fire. No one taken into custody. This is VOA News. Russian protesters have demonstrated by the thousands in cities across the country in support of a call by a Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, for accountability among Russian elite. Over 100 people were detained around Moscow's Pushkin Square, including Navalny, for protesting without permission. One of the others is Natalia. She says, "We're here against corruption to protest what's happening in Russia." Navalny, a Kremlin critic, called the demonstrations, the publishing a detailed report earlier this month accusing the prime minister of amassing a collection of mansions, yachts, and vineyards through a shadowy network of nonprofit organizations. U.S. military officials say that the U.S.-led coalition launched an airstrike that killed more than 100 people during a battle to retake Mosul from Islamic State militants. U.S. Central Command said Saturday that a review determined that a U.S.-led coalition operation requested by the Iraqi government had struck Islamic State fighters and equipment at the location, corresponding to allegations of civilian casualties. What happened in the incident on March 17th in Mosul is still unclear. Some residents say that a coalition airstrike hit an explosive-filled truck, detonating a blast that collapsed buildings packed with families. The Mosul municipality chief, who is supervising the rescue, said 240 bodies had been pulled from the rubble of collapsed buildings. Lise Grant is the UN's humanitarian coordinator in Iraq.
We're waiting to see what the results of the investigation are. We know that there have been many, many families that have been impacted by this tragedy and that there are a large number of injured, a large number of deaths.
The U.S. announcement came after the Iraqi government announced Saturday that it would temporarily halt the battle to retake Mosul from Islamic State jihadists after reports emerged of heavy civilian casualties. A China-influenced committee has chosen Carrie Lam as Hong Kong's next leader. China's communist leadership had lobbied behind the scenes for Lam, so her victory came as no surprise. John Tseng, the widely popular candidate, came in second. The elite election committee was at the root of the protests as activists decried the lack of a direct choice by Hong Kong's 3.8 million registered voters.
"To me, unity must be built step by step on solid ground. It is through real work and actual results that I will respond to those who support me and garner the recognition of those yet to support me. Deeds speak louder than words."
Lam speaking after the election on Pulling Together. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The Small Arms Championship is more or less like a training activity where formations and units of the Nigerian Army compete, by firing small arms.
The Nigerian Army begins a Small Arms Championship challenge in the Sambisa Forest Monday.
Today, about 2.5 million Somali refugees and IDPs live in camps in and out of the country. Tragically, some have lived in the camps for three generations.
The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, a major regional grouping, has agreed to facilitate the voluntary return of refugees.
We have entered an agreement, an exploration production sharing agreement, with the Orento Petroleum Company. It is a Nigerian-based company. The deal that we have signed, they will immediately start exploring in Block B3 in the former Jonglei State.
And critics fault the South Sudanese government for signing a bad oil deal. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian Army will engage in a Small Arms Championship beginning Monday in the Sambisa Forest. Until recently, the forest was the stronghold of Boko Haram. Officials say the championship forms part of the Army's training activities with the aim of sharpening the marksmanship of soldiers. For more, I reach the Nigerian military spokesman, Brigadier General Sani Kukashika Usman.
The Small Arms Championship is more or less like a training activity where formations and units of the Nigerian Army compete by firing small arms. But this is unique in the sense that for the past 10 years or thereabout, we have not had that training program. But the present Chief of Army Staff has revived it. Of course, you know the significance of Sambisa Forest. Whoever is following with keen interest on the fight against terrorism and insurgency in this country will understand that we have decimated and successfully routed out Boko Haram terrorists in all their known camps and enclaves, except Sambisa Forest that time. And with the recapture of Sambisa Forest, particularly their operational and administrative headquarters in Camp Zairo, it goes without saying that we need to consolidate further by maintaining significant presence there.
By being in the Sambisa Forest, will the Army be prepared for a possible ambush? Because Sambisa Forest used to be the main hideout of Boko Haram insurgents.
Yeah, exactly. We are not taking anything for granted, and that is why we have beefed up security. And remember, the fight against terrorism and insurgency, apart from being a collective effort, among all Nigerians, the armed forces are always working in tandem with each other. So it, apart from the efforts of the Nigerian Army, the Nigerian Air Force is equally at hand to ensure that the place is secured and no thing is taken for granted. Invariably, adequate security measures have been put in place, and we are not taking anything for granted in case if there is any breach of security.
What message does the Army want to portray to Nigerians following the choice of Sambisa Forest, peculiar as some people say it might be, to have that training there?
Yeah, exactly. The message is unequivocal and quite clear that Boko Haram is becoming history in our country.
So what entails in this training?
Well, quite a number of activities have been lined up. First and foremost, there will be competition among individuals and formations, firing various caliber of small arms. And apart from that, there will equally be the firing of high caliber weapons that we have in our inventory. And we also have some humanitarian activities that going to take place, medical outreach, as well as seminar for teachers. You know, education has been affected adversely in this part of the country, and we need to, you know, enhance the skill of the teachers so that they can be able to deliver, their mandate as teachers, you know, for the upbringing of our children. And apart from that, there are also going to be a stakeholders meeting, you know, with the traditional, leaders of this part of the country, so that, you know, to emphasize on the need for more security consciousness, more vigilance, and emphasize also on the fact that the fight against terrorism and insurgency is a collective responsibility, that every Nigerian has a role to play, and so that people will also be able to be, you know, giving information about security issues, as the case may be.
Who is going to lead this training session? Because initial report has said that the Commander-in-Chief, President Muhammadu Buhari, is supposed to chair this event. Also, how long will this training last?
That's right. The President Commander-in-Chief is the special guest of honor, and he is going to be represented by the Honorable Minister of Defense. And the event will last for a whole week, from Monday to Friday.
Brigadier General Sani Kukashika Usman is the spokesman for the Nigerian Army. He spoke with me from the Sambisa Forest in Borno State, northeast Nigeria. A Cameroonian court has again adjourned a trial for a foreign reporter accused nearly 2 years ago of complicity with the terrorist group Boko Haram. The reporter says he has done nothing wrong, but remains in custody for nearly 5 months and faces a death sentence. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Radio France International's Hausa language correspondent Ahmed Abba arrived at the Yaoundé military court, escorted by soldiers. He looked healthy for the cross-examination, which was the first hearing since he appeared in court in November 2016. During the cross-examination, to find out how he got videos and photos purportedly from the terrorist group Boko Haram, Abba said he downloaded some from YouTube and Facebook, while others were being shared on other social media. Asked how he got information security services had discovered on his phone announcing planned attacks that never came to pass, the RFI reporter said all the information he had was shared on social media. Abba questioned why the court did not believe him, adding that he also was threatened by Boko Haram, which might have gotten his telephone number from his Facebook page. Cameroon Judicial Police said it interpreted discussions allegedly conducted between Boko Haram members and Abba speaking in the Hausa language. One of the messages was about a planned airplane attack, and another, which Abba claimed was from a friend, invited him to pray and fast during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Defense witness Yves Rockel, head of the African News section of RFI, testified Abba has been an objective reporter since he joined them. Defense counsel Charles Chungang says the cross-examination sounded intimidating, but he was happy the trial had at last begun.
Vous savez qu'avant, il a été détenu au secret pendant 3 mois. On peut pas savoir où il était. Et comme vous l'avez entendu dire, il a été torturé.
He says nobody knew the whereabouts of Abba 3 months after he was arrested. He says he was arbitrarily arrested. And he says that notwithstanding, he has noted with satisfaction that the court case is now respecting its normal proceedings. The case has been adjourned until April 6 to enable RFI to provide written documents that Abba is their correspondent in Cameroon. The court said verbal testimony from Yves Rockel was not enough. Abba was arrested in northern Cameroon in July 2015 and taken to Yaoundé 2 weeks later. Abba faces charges of complicity in terrorism and failing to denounce acts of terror, according to the charge sheet provided by the court. He also is accused of acting as an accomplice with two members of Boko Haram. Prosecutors also accuse him of failing to warn authorities of activities of the Boko Haram. The Committee to Protect Journalist Media Freedom Organization sent a letter to Cameroon President Paul Biya early this year, calling for Abba to be released and charges against him to be dropped. Cameroon introduced capital punishment for involvement in terror attacks or complicity in terrorism in 2014. Abba's first court appearance was in November 2015. If convicted, he could be sentenced to death. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The leaders of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development Regional Grouping met in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Saturday. The group agreed to facilitate the voluntary return of refugees and address the political and security situation in Somalia. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Eight leaders from Eastern Africa met in Nairobi to discuss the situation of Somali refugees in the region. The meeting was held 2 months before the planned Dadaab refugee camp closure by the Kenyan government. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta insists the refugee camp in the northeast part of his country is no longer just a sanctuary for refugees, but is the scene of criminal and terror activities too.
Instead, the Dadaab has become a protracted situation characterized by hopelessness that easily feeds environmental destruction, conflicts between refugees and host communities, insecurity, radicalization, criminality, and also allows terrorist operatives to exploit it for their operational efforts.
More than 200,000 refugees live in the Dadaab refugee camp. Close to 1 million Somalis are refugees in neighboring countries. Kenya hosts a third of those, and Ethiopia is home to 250,000 of Somalis. The region is also facing a humanitarian crisis. More than 17 million are affected by drought and are in need of aid assistance. The leaders said there was a need to respond to the humanitarian crisis to prevent new displacement of people. Observers fear the current crisis may threaten the lives of refugees returning to Somalia, where 6 million, half of the population, is hungry. The heads of the nations in the summit said that voluntary repatriation is not the only option and has urged other countries to come forward and share responsibility through settling some of the refugees in third countries. Somali President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed says his compatriots tell him the situation back at home has forced them to leave in camps.
Today, about 2.5 million Somali refugees and IDPs live in camps in and out of the country. Tragically, some have lived in the camps for three generations, all because the environment was not conducive enough in Somalia for them to return.
Mohamed says his government will call on the rest of the nations in the region to improve the security situation.
We will increase our effort to jointly achieve the objectives of this conference on the voluntary return of our people in a safe and dignified manner, and to provide durable solutions so that they can participate in the rebuilding of prosperous and peaceful Somalia at peace and harmony with itself and its neighbors.
Kenya, Uganda, Djibouti, Burundi, and Ethiopia have sent troops to Somalia to support the government and fight Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Operations, George Obo, says creating a safe place for refugees will require a collective effort.
Solutions for refugees and the internally displaced are, however, fundamentally linked to resolving conflict and building stability inside Somalia. But these should not be pursued as sequential steps. Rather, we need to engage a range of tools and actors to help build the conditions that will allow those refugees who are ready to return home to do so voluntarily.
The UN's refugee agency is calling for a joint effort to mitigate the effect of drought and avert famine in the region to reduce the suffering of the population in eastern Africa. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The South Sudanese government has come under criticism for signing a bad oil deal with Urantu Petroleum Limited, a Nigerian company. Critics say it is unacceptable that the deal will ensure the company becomes a 90% shareholder. They also say the government has lined up several oil deals with multinational companies despite the ongoing conflict, an indication, they said, of the government's gross disregard for the country's peace. For reaction, I reached South Sudanese Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Lol Gatkot.
We have entered an agreement, exploration production sharing agreement, with the Urantu Petroleum Company. It is a Nigerian-based company. The deal that we have signed, they will immediately start exploring in Block B3 in former Jonglei State. It's a very lucrative block. Potential is very high. It used to be owned by Total, but we have divided it into three blocks. Block B1, B2, and B3. So B3 has been taken by Urantu. B1 and B2, Total, and other companies will be involved in. So this deal is a very good deal compared to the other companies that are producing in South Sudan.
The company is the 90% shareholder and operator of the large block B3, which means the government gets only 10%, which critics say it's unfortunate because the oil belongs to South Sudanese.
When you are actually exploring, for example, if you heard of the production now, the producing blocks that are being produced, Petronas has 41% of the share, and CNPC has 32% of the share, and then you have Sinopec for 8%, you have other companies that are actually... So Nalpet, which is the government-owned company, in those blocks are having only 5%. The block B3, Urantu has 90%, Nalpet has 10%. We have actually given more shares to Nalpet now compared to other blocks. That's one. Two, you know, there is risk involved.
There are concerns that the money that will be accrued from this petroleum deal will be used by the government to purchase more weapons, to create more instability, to attack opponents, including the SPLM-IO. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, let me tell you something. If you are engaging any company to do business anywhere in the world, you cannot get the company's money and to divert them and do something else. This is an investment from the company and by the company. What we are creating is actually providing opportunities for them to come and invest their money. Their money is for the production of oil, and their money is for the exploration of the oil, and their money is actually investment in the oil so that they can get their returns. There is nothing like the $500 million that we are signed with Urantu. They will be actually investing this money into exploration, that's one. And then when the exploration is done, they will now produce the blocks, that's two. And then when the blocks is being produced, now they will actually sell the crude so that they make money, so that they can get the returns of their investment. There is no way the government of South Sudan will use this money to buy weapons and to fight the war. And for your information, we have an agreement signed. Peace is there. Juba is peaceful. And we are calling for those who are still pursuing violence to come and then to join the process of peacemaking.
With this flurry of activities of oil deals that you have been signing on behalf of the government, wouldn't you be putting the workers' lives in danger because the country remains unstable? There are pockets of fighting in parts of the country that is forcing a lot of South Sudan refugees to run across the border into neighboring countries, including Uganda.
We will make sure that the lives and properties of the investors are protected by the government. We have a force called Petroleum Unit, that is actually a petroleum protection force that is designated to protect the oil installations and the workers who are actually working in the oil fields. And this is the combination, it is actually a combination of the SPLA, the National Army, the national security, and the police. This is the force that is exclusively designated and authorized to protect the oil.
Ezekiel Lol Gatkuth is the South Sudanese Petroleum Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. Tanzanian President John Pombe Magufuli has warned journalists that there is a limit to their comment and press freedom. His remark came after calling on his new information minister, Harrison Mwakembe, to crack down on media publications which could undermine the country's unity and stability. Last week, Nape Nnauye, the former information minister, was fired for criticizing an ally of the president who had threatened journalists at a private station for refusing to broadcast a video. For reaction to the president's warning, I reached Tumaini Makeni, spokesman for the Tanzanian main opposition group, Chadema.
We are also increasing so much concern, even being shocked up by the way His Excellency John Magufuli is handling critiques and the criticism which are being laid towards his government generally, or against his some of his words or actions. We are seeing a sharp divergence or a sharp shift of paradigm. At the beginning, when he was coming to power, he was even nicknamed by the media locally. He was nicknamed as a bulldozer, being a name coming from Tinga Tinga, because of his leadership style when he was viewed to be strict to some of the issue. But as time goes on, we have just come to note that President Magufuli is not that much positive to criticism.
In his warning to journalists, he said he will not tolerate publication of materials that will undermine the stability of the country. Isn't he right by that? Because the constitution mandates the president to not only protect the life and property of Tanzanians, but to also ensure the country's territorial integrity is protected.
There are a lot of discussions. When the president, you can say he was so precise, but he has no specification, he has no specific examples which, you know, kind of publications endangered or put in danger the stability of the country or political stability. There's no example, there are no specific issues who could have mentioned, but the discussion are, even the president himself was caught saying why some of the issue he thinks on his own view could have been in the front page of the newspapers or could have been given, good airtime on electronic media.
Do you think the president was right on calling his new information minister to pay closer attention to publications that the government will deem as having the ability to create disunity and undermine the country's peace and stability?
I will respond to this question from two point of views. One, from professional point of view, as I'm a trained journalist. Second, my career-wise. I would say this. It wasn't proper for a president to threaten the media or to give an unfriendly comment to the media in such a public, in such a way, the way president made it. It wasn't even proper for a president ordering the newly appointed information minister, instead of creating a good rapport and good environment for the press freedom to be well excited according to the constitution of the country and according to the law of the land.
Tumaini Makene is the spokesman for the Tanzanian main opposition group Chadema. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Next on Let's Talk. What do women want in a relationship? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests chatting about women and relationships. Let's Talk comes to you Monday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. At the 42nd edition of the IAAF World Cross Country Championships, it was a clean sweep for Kenya in senior women. In fact, besides taking all the medals, Kenya took the 4th, 5th, and 6th positions. Irene Cheptai took gold. Alice Eperon, Naouna Silver, and Lillian Rengruk bronze. Overall, the top three favorite nations earned gold. Kenya took the mixed relay, Ethiopia the under 20 women, and host Uganda a first ever in the under 20 men. Jacob Kiplimo won Uganda's first gold medal at the 2017 World Cross Country Championships, crossing the line with a time of 22.40 minutes in the under 20 men race. Ethiopia's underwork Walelen took silver, while Kenya's Kimunyan settled for bronze. In the men's under 20 team standings, Ethiopia took gold with 17 points ahead of Kenya, 27, and Eritrea 55. Uganda missed out on bronze by 1 point. In the final race of the day, the senior men's 10 kilometers, Kenya's Geoffrey Kamworo successfully defended his title. A first back-to-back senior men's winner since 2006. Teammate Leonard Baston came in second in a race that was dominated by Uganda's Joshua Cheptegei until the last lap when the Ugandan fell apart. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's athletics legend Haile Gebrselassie is set to participate in the inaugural Great South Sudanese Run in Juba on April 8th. Gebrselassie, who is also part of the organizing committee of the South Sudan race, made the announcement in Addis Ababa on Thursday. The Olympic gold medalist is the founder and chairperson of the Great Ethiopian Run. The Great South Sudanese Run's main objective is to promote peace in the war-torn country that is facing famine, according to the organizers, who include the Ethiopian Great Run and Ayashina Teka, an Ethiopian investor in South Sudan. Some 5,000 participants are expected to take part in the 10-kilometer run that will be made an annual event to promote sports, peace, and unity. In football, CAF have confirmed the group stage draw for the 2017 Champions League and Confederation Cup will take place on April 26th. The draws for the 16 qualified teams for the group phase of Toto CAF Champions League 2017 and the Toto CAF Confederation Cup 2017 will take place on Wednesday, April 26th at the CAF headquarters in Cairo. After a 3-2 aggregate win over KCCA, reigning Champions League winners Mamelodi Sundowns enter the draw in Port 1 alongside Al Ahly, Zamalek, and Etoile du Sahel. TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo suffered a shock exit from this year's African Champions League, losing on the away goals ruling to Zimbabwe's Cups United in Harare. Mazembe, the club that won the African Champions League in 2015, now drop into the African Confederation Cup playoff round, where they will look to defend the title they won in 2016. The result is a huge accomplishment for CAPS United of Zimbabwe, who have returned to the CAF Champions League after an 11-year absence. They will now enter the group phase of the tournament, which has been expanded from 8 to 16 clubs. Also, Djibouti registered a first international victory since 2007 on Wednesday when they beat South Sudan at the start of the race to the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations. They won the game 2-0 at home to take the lead in their two-leg preliminary round tie. In the other match, Madagascar beat Sao Tome and Principe 1-0. The teams are competing for places in the main group phase of the qualifying competition. An overall win will take them into Group C in the race for Cameroon 2019, where they'll face Burundi, Gabon, and Mali. In Wednesday's other match, an own goal from Sao Tome's Jordão Diogo gave the Malagasy the win. The winner of the tie will head to Group A with Equatorial Guinea, Senegal and Sudan. The third preliminary round tie was an Indian Ocean derby between the Comoros Islands and Mauritius, with the first leg in Moroni on Friday. Comoros came out on top 2-0, giving them a health advantage for the return game on Tuesday, April 28th. And just before we go, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Secretary General Hicham El Amrani resigned on Sunday, just over a week after long-standing President Issa Hayatou was ousted from power following defeat to Madagascar's Ahmed in the elections. El Amrani, in a letter to African football associations, said he would be departing on Monday, but he gave no reason for his decision. The 37-year-old Moroccan had served as Secretary General for the last 6 years. And that's it for this edition of Netline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Netline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Just begun. Hey, I'm so glad I found you now. My words. stones. And this perfect mathematics when to become one. Baby, you're the air I breathe. Baby, girl, you complete me. What's in our good day if it will be you? So good, darling, is this for real? When I see you, you can make me go girl blind. Cause you shine like a diamond, so bright.
there's no backbone. When your strength lets you down and your friends ain't around, spend your night on my shoulder. When money talks too much and everybody is talking trash.
Girl, I know how you dey feel. That kind of feeling you dey feel. Now the same way where I dey feel. But we no come short if it be real. I know you want trouble, banku. Boy, I need bello, my darko. Honey, it's a critical situation. Very tempting association. Chukuma, he break your heart. Eugenia, she teach your man. And if best fit, take your man. I'm sorry to say that it's not your man. Wait and be your own. Be your own, leave him alone. We take it one step at a time. We go get there somewhere, somehow.
Hold on. When he enter, you go feel love. Make you no rush, this love. Hold on. When he enter, you go feel love. Oh. Hold on. When it's inside.
Like Russian roulette, you know, yeah. I know say your time they go, but that don't mean say romance be true love. Oh baby, take your time, you know. Cause when love holds you, now there you go, no. For now, let's chill as we proceed, now there you go, no.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Most regrettably and unexpectedly, Morocco disrupted a vital meeting last week in Dakar, convened to tackle crucial issues involving the African continent. The meeting was the 10th joint annual meeting of the African Union and the Economic Commission of Africa, a subsidiary organ of the United Nations. This session of the meeting was scheduled to deliberate on the scene of growth, inequality, and unemployment. The conference was also scheduled to explore measures for reducing inequality and extreme poverty on the continent in order to achieve the targets of the first 10-year implementation plan 2013 to 2023 of Agenda 2063 and the goals of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, among other issues. Morocco objected to the presence of the delegation of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, more or less the Polisario Front. And this was very surprising because it had been expected that a new course would be followed after Morocco re-entered the African Union in January of this year. It may be recalled that Morocco in 1984 had withdrawn from the then Organization of African Unity after that organization admitted the Polisario Front as an independent entity. It should be also borne in mind that the Polisario Front has been recognized by the United Nations as representing the Sahrawi Republic. And the surprise was that when Morocco decided, after very effective lobbying of African countries, was admitted in January, it was felt that it was now prepared to work out new arrangements with the Polisario Front, because it knew when it went for a new admission that the Polisario Front was still there with its flag flying in the headquarters in Addis Ababa. So what was the purpose of this? Now, the Moroccan government has followed a practice in the past by not sitting together with the representative of the Polisario Front in meetings. And now that it is a member, it's argued that the SARB should not be participating at this meeting in Dakar. This was a very annoying to the delegates who try to appeal to the Moroccans to find an African solution to this problem. And this went on and on and on, arguing back and forth. Now, the delegates were suggesting, why should Morocco raise this issue when it was now a full member of the African Union? Of course, the Polisario delegates accused Morocco of trying to disrupt and divide the African Union. This is not the very first time that Morocco has raised objections. Even in the United Nations, in the African group, Morocco would raise strong objection to the presence of the Polisario Front. Now, this is also true that in other meetings, even with the Arab Summit meeting, that the Moroccans would raise very strong objection. Now, what is being suggested is that Morocco should review its position and see whether it could not find another means to express its opinion. In diplomatic parlance, there are many ways to find an opening. But this was a purely technical meeting. And in technical meetings of the sort in Dakar, this is not where you flex your diplomatic muscles. And one would hope that in the future, that Morocco and both the African Union should find a way to stop all these disruptions we have seen in many places involving Morocco and the Polisario Front. It is time for Africans to be serious, to deal with issues such as youth unemployment, which was on the table in this conference, and not to bring in issues which are not going to help what goes on the African continent. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, pretend you are dead and you will see who really loves you. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid drug that mimics the effects of heroin and indeed is added to that illicit drug to increase its potency. It is relatively easy to make and even easier to smuggle. Due to its high potency, which is 50 times greater than heroin and 100 times greater than morphine, a package the size of a sugar pack may contain as many as 100 doses of fentanyl. And it is deadly. An amount the size of 3 grains of sugar is lethal to an adult. In the United States, nearly 20,000 overdose deaths in 2015 involved heroin or synthetic opioids such as fentanyl. Fentanyl, a restricted medication due to its high potential for abuse, has been widely used for legitimate purposes since 1960, first as a general anesthetic during surgery, and today as a painkiller to treat severe pain. But it has also become popular as a recreational drug. Much of the supply for this market is produced illicitly, and because accurately dosing this opioid is very difficult, the incidence of fatal overdoses is high. Fentanyl is internationally controlled under the Single Convention on Narcotics Drugs. But by changing just one molecule in the formula, an illicit manufacturer creates what's known as an analog of fentanyl, a version of the drug that has the same effects but is legal only because it isn't the exact same chemical composition as fentanyl itself. To counter this practice, the United Nations on March 16th added the two main chemicals necessary for the manufacture of fentanyl to its international list of controlled substances. With this decision, illicit producers of fentanyl and fentanyl analogs will lose the easy access to the essential precursor chemicals used to produce fentanyl and fentanyl analogs. Adding these precursor chemicals to the 1988 convention will make it more difficult for traffickers to access them for illicit purposes because they will now be subject to increased regulation by UN member states, said Director of the Office of Policy, Planning and Coordination for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, Kara McDonald. I want to express the gratitude of my government for this show of solidarity and support in voting to internationally control precursor chemicals to fentanyl. Let there be no mistake. This vote today will save lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.